Before we start, a quick reminder. This podcast discusses sex, violence, and social oppression. It may be uncomfortable or triggering to some. If you're listening out loud, parts of this narrative may seem sensitive to those around you. Shashi Tharoor, the well-spoken and articulate Member of Parliament, tried more than once to get India's anti-gay sex law repealed. This is him delivering a speech in the Lok Sabha during one such attempt in 2016.
Unfortunately for us, the British came and they passed laws in the Indian Penal Code and after that have criminalized a whole lot of human behavior and human reality that in India have not been criminal. It is ironic to see the self-appointed defenders of Bharatiya Sanskriti on the treasury benches now acting as the defenders of the worst prejudices of British Victorian morality.
We'll come back to the point that he makes. But for now, I want to focus on something else. Shashi Tharoor is known for his big words, British-ish accent, and excellent command of the English language.
I mean, my parents would embarrass me too when guests came over. Shashi, uncle ko angrezi bolke sunao na. I go, Daddy, please. I can't entertain this. Pardon my recalcitrance.
Tharoor symbolizes a generation of Indians who inherited a complicated legacy after independence. They are sometimes referred to as Macaulay's children, anglicized, English medium educated, grappling with the aftermath of British rule. Now, who was Macaulay and why did he have so many fake children even though he had none in his real life?
It is, I believe, no exaggeration.
Thomas Babington Macaulay was a 19th century British colonial officer. He ensured English was taught in India because he believed the entirety of writing in Sanskrit, Arabic, and Persian was all worthless when compared to European literature. He wanted to create an English-educated class of Indians that would help the British rule over the native masses. He famously phrased it like this.
Indian in blood and
colour,
but English in taste,
in opinions,
in morals,
and in intellect. He also wrote the Indian Penal Code, the set of laws that India continues to enforce till today. Why is he important to this podcast? Why was his name mentioned 25 times in the judgment against 377? Because he wrote the law. As the author of the IPC, he was also responsible for Section 377. The man responsible for a large part of the education system is also the one who wrote our laws. That's no coincidence. From ATS Studio, I'm Sindhuri Nandakumar, and this is 377, a show about a very specific law, its outsized impact on Indian society, and the movement to get rid of it. In our last episode, we talked about the HIV/AIDS crisis in India, how gay men, a largely invisible community in India, were starting to safeguard themselves from the deadly virus through the repeal of this law.
Many of them got up and fought. They said they were going to die anyway, and they were going to fight to make life better for other people who were either at risk of HIV or had HIV. So they became the most incredible fighters. It was a disease that really transformed people because there was so much stigma and so much hatred of people with AIDS and so much fear.
Today we are going to talk about the history of 377. Where that stigma came from, and how homophobia became so intrinsic to Indian society. Like Mr. Tharoor noted, how did staunch Hindu groups become defenders of a law steeped in British morality? They argued that homosexuality was un-Indian, that it's a Western import. But if anything is a Western import, it's homophobia.
Something that's still ruining lives today, it will be hard to think of a better example than the British Penal Code, also known as Section 377. This homophobic law is the reason why being gay is still illegal in at least 30 former British colonies.
377 came to us from colonial England. It was modeled on a 16th century law from the time of Henry VIII, and it was rooted in Christian morality. Today, even though England has done away with its own anti-queer laws, many of us in former Commonwealth nations continue to live under them.
Nobody
in 2018, Theresa May, then Prime Minister of the UK, offered a public apology on behalf of her country.
Across the world, discriminatory laws made many years ago continue to affect the lives of many people, criminalising same-sex relations and failing to protect women and girls. I am all too aware that these laws were often put in place by my own country. They were wrong then, and they are wrong now. Nobody should face persecution or discrimination because of who they are or who they love.
Now, I want to be careful about romanticizing pre-colonial India. These were diverse regions and territories that we today know as one country. I don't want to generalize. Yes, we do have depictions of homosexuality in our history. The Khajuraho paintings, the Manusmriti texts, the Kama Sutra mentions a third sex and even has a detailed chapter on male-male sexual relations. India also has a vibrant and rich history of trans culture. But I'm wary of making the broad claim that before the British came, queer people got all of the respect that they deserved. I discussed this with Dr. Ruth Vanita.
Just Ruth Vanita, and I'm professor at the University of Montana. Earlier, I had taught at the University of Delhi for many years.
She's a scholar who has done a lot of research into the history of pre-colonial India. And I asked her about the attitudes towards homosexuality before the British came.
Earlier literature before the British period, before the colonial period, we find in many Indian languages, texts from many Indian languages, which I have read, including Sanskrit and later modern languages like Bengali, Hindi, Urdu, etc., that same-sex relations are openly discussed and with a whole range of views. It's not that everyone likes it or approves of it, but there's a whole range of views, I would say, from a mild disapproval to an open celebration, right? And everything in between, but it was never unspeakable. Whereas in Europe, from about the 13th century onwards, and definitely from the 16th century onwards, I would say from the 16th century onwards, actually, it's not only treated as sinful, but also as illegal, made criminal, which was not the case. And it is also comes to be called the sin that is not nameable among Christians, should not be named.
Ruth also says that Hinduism, the dominant religion in the region, was not intrinsically homophobic.
Okay, first I should clarify, there are many Hindus who are homophobic. So the people is different from what the religious texts say. There is a difference between those two things, which one should be very clear, right? Hinduism has thousands of texts and they all say various things. But overall, reading the texts, one finds that there isn't any similar kind of horror and disgust at same-sex relations. There are other kinds of sexual relations that are even treated as much worse and penalized much more harshly.
That horror and disgust came into Indian jurisprudence through Section 377. At the time, the British wanted to create a set of laws to govern the regions they controlled. They wanted these laws to apply to their own citizens who were stationed in the colonies and also to the locals, natives who needed to be educated and taught British morals. One particular fear was that British officers would be encouraged to engage in sexually fluid activities, including gay sex. Some of them had left wives and girlfriends behind, and this worried the British administrators, who felt that Indian culture wasn't as restrictive as their own. All in all, a moral order had to be enforced. It was therefore Macaulay's duty to put into legalese that sodomy was wrong. So the word sodomy confuses me. The producer of this show, Ashim, and I spent a bit of time trying to figure out the best definition of the word. And we couldn't really pin it down because the meaning has expanded over time.
So you want to talk about sodomy?
Yeah. So I know it's a biblical term.
Yeah. From the towns, Sodom and Gomorrah. The Bible doesn't really elaborate too much, but God apparently said their sin is very grievous. Most interpretations seem to say that sin is gay sex, but it could also have been non-consensual.
So he basically destroyed them with fire and brimstone.
Yeah, I think that was God's solution to many problems. Fire and brimstone.
Okay. Okay, so I get that, but then I feel like it just goes into murky territory, right? Like,
yeah.
By some definitions, sodomy is gay sex and bestiality. But then others say even straight couples who have oral or anal sex are also sodomites.
Yeah, it becomes this sort of catch-all for things people don't like. It's the biblical version of wuzu. If they don't want to talk about something, they brush it under the rug and they call it sodomy.
So then it just becomes the equivalent of immoral sex.
Yeah, immoral. Yeah. It makes it hard to turn into a law, though. You can't exactly say that immoral things are illegal. You have to define them.
Yeah, true. Okay, thanks, Ashim. Macaulay had this same problem. He had trouble defining the word. But his concern was also that he didn't want to make the definition too explicit in case it gave anyone ideas. Lawyer and historian Alok Gupta explains this process.
She used to always say, and you can laugh about it, that if you define it too accurately, it will only create interest in it. So you have to define it surreptitiously, furtively. So only we know what we're talking about.
Remember, we're talking about a law that should be defined so no one understands it.
He first defined it as the offense of unnatural touching because he was so scared of defining an offense that would relate to sex. He said anybody touches anybody with unnatural lust in their mind is sodomy. And the court judge and the committee was like, this is absurd. This is too vague. You know, come up with something less vague. And that's when he came up with this definition, which we have.
That was 1860, and the law was approved.
Have you got a section in front of you?
No, I have it somewhere.
I go through the wording with Anand Grover, the activist lawyer we met in the last episode. It may seem excessive to go through it word by word, but this is the law. The words make all the difference, and interpreting them is what judges do all day.
Yeah, whoever voluntarily has carnal intercourse against the
order of nature, with a man, woman, or an animal,
shall be punished with imprisonment for life.
Yeah.
The problem is, they're so vague. Carnal intercourse meaning sex, against the order of nature. Who's going to speak on behalf of nature and what is and is not against it? I mean, just in my family, my mother and I wouldn't agree on what constitutes unnatural behavior. How are lawyers and judges expected to reach a consensus when someone's life hangs in the balance? An important aspect of law is that it can be applied consistently, that it means the same thing to everyone. The vague terminology meant that the law could be applied in a range of situations. And the judges could use their own biases and moral codes to decide how it could be enforced. The US Supreme Court in 1964, when trying to ban pornography, famously used the phrase, "I'll know it when I see it." That's arbitrary. That gives judges a lot of individual power, and exactly that was happening with 377. The application of the law kept expanding. Certain acts that were not considered criminal were later successfully charged under 377. For example, oral sex. Originally, penetration was necessary if you wanted to book someone under the law, but penetration isn't well defined either. So the courts found creative ways of proving it had happened. I asked Anand about this.
Well, that is because over a period of time, in the earlier part, you know, it's like a more than a century. The judgments have gone over for 100 years. Over a period of time, though earlier it was penetration in the mouth, anus, later on, they actually didn't look at only at penetration, but they looked at what they call sexual perversity. So penetration had to be satisfied. And penetration, if you have hold the penis in the wrist, that would actually constitute penetration. Or penetration between the thighs.
When being charged under 377, you have to be caught in the act. You had to have an invasive medical examination that would check if you were a habitual sodomite. That was a lot of work for the police, and often just not possible.
All hell broke loose after that time.
Remember Siddharth's arrest from episode 2?
He called in these other policemen and he said, lock them up.
377 wasn't mentioned, only implied. No evidence was required. If you can't prove it, charging someone with a crime just becomes a threat. It's police brutality. I spoke with Dr. Jyoti Puri, a professor of sociology at Simmons University in the US.
It's wielded as a threat, as a kind of baton, but it hasn't really found its way in the courts, especially the higher courts. And the medical examination component has something directly to do with it. So typically, when people have wanted to harass somebody under this law, including members of the police, if they wanted to extort or harass somebody or commit physical violence or even demand sex, etc., they have been using the threat of Section 377, but they have not been booking people under it because of the medical examination component, because it requires that kind of substantiation, which, you know, doesn't happen.
Jyoti has written a book titled Sexual States, Governance in the Struggle Over the Anti-Sodomy Law in India. And I relied on it to get a sense of how the law was being used. Jyoti was able to get information on around 99 cases in the high courts. One thing that struck her was how consistently these cases had to do with child sexual assault. And it surprised her that a law that was used to prosecute child abuse cases became the emblem of the gay rights movement in India.
In one sense, yes, the spirit of Section 377 certainly introduced and institutionalized homophobia into Indian legal history. But the fact that this is primarily about child sexual assault should make us hesitant about seeing this as the institutionalization of, you know, the homosexual in a way that is true for some places in the West, right? And I think it is more accurate and it would be more nuanced to make the claim that in fact, despite the intent of Section 377 against homosexuality, it has been wielded mostly in terms of filling the gap around child sexual assault because rape laws were simply not enough.
Now, just to be clear, Jyoti isn't defending the law. When I asked her to explain what she meant, she made a very good point. Because their acts were punishable under the same law as child sex offenders, sexually active gay men were described in the same negative terms.
So there is no space, no understanding, no legitimacy for same-sex desire. There is an implicit denigration of it, even though this is all about child sexual assault.
That's the thing about Section 377. If you're a queer person, it makes you feel like a criminal. It gives other people and the law the chance to equate your desires with troubling, problematic behavior. And the reason it was used to prosecute a gamut of crimes was because India's laws on child abuse and rape were very, very restrictive. India's rape laws, for example, only apply if the victim is a woman. Thankfully, in 2012, the POCSO Act, that's Protection of Children from Sexual Offences, was passed, and it provides far better protection to minors. But this law didn't stop with India.
Criminalizing same-sex relations.
Remember Theresa May's apology?
Women and girls.
The UK did kind of ruin gay sex for a lot of people because 377 became a model for other Commonwealth countries. Here's the scholar Alok Gupta again.
But then we discovered that this law traveled to Southeast Asia. It traveled to East Africa. It traveled to Australia. At every point from 1860 onwards, when this law was adopted by another governor, British governor, in his colony, he tweaked with the sodomy provision. We have found 25 different amendments, at least.
A recent study even showed that former British colonies are much more likely to have laws that criminalize homosexual conduct than other states in general. And unlike India, those laws are still in place in some of these countries. In Sri Lanka, it's Section 375A. It was even amended to remove the word men so it could apply to lesbians and trans women. Campaigns against the law haven't always been successful. For example, in Singapore.
In other news, the High Court has rejected all of the latest challenges to Section 377A of the Penal Code.
In Kenya.
We find that the impugned sections are not unconstitutional. Accordingly, the consolidated petitions have no merit.
I want to come back to India now. There are so many fascinating aspects about the history of 377. How much we internalized the homophobia of our colonial rulers. How we made this very British, Victorian-era law an Indian one. And how important education was to all of this. Here's Ruth Vanita again.
And they also, through education, especially English education, they spread the idea that it is wrong. And by the 1920s, we find that most educated Indians have totally internalized this. And they also think that homosexuality should never be mentioned in writing and in public. This modern homophobia is something that comes from the West, to educated people and then from educated people to others.
After the British left, India inherited a complicated legacy. We got the railways, the English language, and a sense of homophobia.
In fact, our tradition is never to regard homosexuality as natural. We regard it as unnatural.
When 377 and the IPC came into effect, it was imposed on the country. Indian citizens couldn't vote. It applied to people who had had no say in creating the legal system. And many of these laws survive till this day. Anjali Gopalan decided that it was time to question the existence of 377. But in 2001, when Anjali decided to file a petition in the Delhi High Court, she was met with resistance. Not only from homophobic people, but also from some child's rights and women's rights groups. You might assume that they would be allies, but they had to safeguard their own interests. They didn't want 377 to go because, until 2012, there were no other laws on child abuse. I asked Anjali about that.
But that's why we had asked for a reading down of the law. We hadn't asked for the abrogation of the law. What we had asked for is to exclude consenting adults.
Abrogation. That would mean scrapping 377 entirely. All of it goes. Reading down would mean excluding consenting gay adults from the law.
So that's why it was not about getting rid of 377. It was about reading down of 377.
There was more. Why go down the legal route? Why focus around just this 377 law? There were larger problems. And why lean so much on the public health angle? Ashley Tellis, an academic and gay rights activist, compared the NAS Foundation's petition with the earlier one filed in 1994 by the AIDS Bhedbhav Virodhi Andolan, or ABVA. This is what he said.
The AIDS Bhedbhav Virodhi Andolan was the first real movement against Section 377, and it called for the repeal entirely of 377. And this was the original campaign, or the original movement. And then this got hijacked by NAS in 2000, and it became a reading down of 377, which is not a repeal, not the removal of that entire section, but a reading down, only to make private consensual sex between adults of the same sex legal. And this seems to me a mistake, because the important thing to have fought for is the removal of 377 and the removal of the entire sodomy statute, because it's fundamentally homophobic and deeply problematic and also comes from a different kind of history.
Did these criticisms hamper the movement? What impact did it have on Anjali and Anand? And how did they regroup and move towards a tremendous victory in 2009? That's in our next episode. Special thanks to Dr. Nancy Nicole and Alok Gupta, who granted us permission to use excerpts from the documentary by Envisioning Global Human Rights at York University, Canada. You can find more details about our research material, including Dr. Ruth Vanita's book, Love's Right, Same-Sex Marriage in India and the West, and Dr. Jyoti Puri's book, in the show notes at allthingssmall.in. 377 is a production of ATS Studio, a division of All Things Small. This episode was hosted by me, Sindhuri Nandakumar, and written by me and Ashim De Silva, who also produced the show. Script supervision is by Deveya Bopanna and Archana Nathan, with editorial input from Sidin Varukut and Supriya Nair. The music and sound design is by Madhav Ayachit, and the episode is mixed and mastered by Ankit Suryakant. Our executive producer is Gaurav Vaz. Our legal consultant is Amshula Prakash. We received administrative support from Anushka Mukherjee. All clips and voices used in this podcast are owned by their original creators. You can find more information about this episode and our show notes at allthingssmall.in/377.